The euro is up, the dollar is down, the Chinese yuan won't budge, and no one is happy. Finance ministers and central bankers from around the world are coming to Washington, D.C. They'll be taking part in the fall meetings of the International Monetary Fund. One item on the agenda, talk of a currency war between the world's biggest economies. We're joined now by David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and a regular guest here on Morning Edition. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee. Welcome back. Dave,
thank you very much. Glad to be back. Tell us exactly, David, how countries would fight a currency war.
Well, in the developed country world, the U.S., Europe, and Japan, economies are operating far from their full potential. Lots of unemployment, not enough domestic demand to get everybody back to work, so everybody would like to export more to get their economy going. But when their currencies are too strong, it makes their exports expensive, and they can't export a lot. So everybody seems to want their currency to come down. But if everybody tries to get their currency down, then of course nobody's currency goes up. And if everybody's trying to use their currency as kind of to get an edge on their trading partners, you could have bad stuff. I mean, the head of the IMF, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, said this week that this could represent a serious risk to the global recovery. It could be negative, damaging, everybody trying to do what's in their own interest, but making the world economy worse off.
Well, give us an example of what a government might be doing right now to weaken its currency.
Well, we see lots of stuff going on. The Japanese government and the Israeli government, others have actually taken the act of selling their currencies and buying dollars in order to push their currency down. The Brazilian government is putting a tax on foreign money coming into the country because so much money is coming into Brazil, it's pushing the currency up. And then, of course, a country can simply make its currency cheaper by printing more of it. And some people say that's what the Federal Reserve's about to do. The U.S. government isn't actively seeking to push the dollar down, but it's no secret that they'd like a slightly lower dollar because that would make it easier for us to export. So the basic problem is that for the world economy to rebalance, the U.S. has to export more and somebody has to export less. Nobody's volunteering for that, least of all the Chinese.
Good. Let's bring the Chinese then into this conversation. U.S. politicians spend a lot of time complaining about China's currency. What do other countries, do they have a problem with China?
Yes, everybody has a problem with China now. China stands out among the big economies of the world. It won't let the market push its currency up. It's accused of holding the currency down. And if it holds its currency down and the dollar needs to fall, then other people's currencies, the Brazilian, the Korean, the Japanese currencies will go up. And they're not happy about this. Basically, when one country decides to peg its currency or prevent this kind of adjustment, it makes it harder for other countries to adjust.
And why wouldn't China want to let its currency get stronger? Is it the same reason it wants to be able to export and then that would hurt its export possibilities?
The Chinese are afraid. They're afraid of currency instability. They're afraid of being pushed around by the United States. And they're afraid if their export industry slow down, then they'll have a lot of unemployment and restlessness and political instability. The Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao said in Europe this week that it would bring disaster to China if the yuan, its currency, rose by 20 or 40%, as some people are suggesting. He said many of our factories will shut down. Our society will be in turmoil. Lay off. But no one's listening to that.
Well, just briefly, this weekend's meeting, resolve any of these tensions?
I doubt it. There's a lot of posturing ahead of the meeting. There'll be some tough face-to-face meetings for domestic political reasons. China and the U.S. and everybody has a reason to talk tough in public. The U.S. is ratcheting up the pressure, but I don't have any reason to expect a resolution or any dramatic public confrontation. This is just one more step in a long-running war.
Okay, conversation about the IMF meeting this weekend. David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and a regular guest here on Morning Edition. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Climate talks underway this week in China have failed so far to make much progress. That's according to the chief U.S. negotiator, Jonathan Pershing, who says, and I quote, "There is less agreement than one might have hoped to find."
Unfortunately, this would seem to fit a pattern. There was the Bitter Summit last year in Copenhagen, which produced only a vague and non-binding treaty. Copenhagen was followed by another gathering this year in Germany, and this week's China talks are a setup for next month's UN Climate Summit in Cancun, Mexico, which also apparently is not expected to produce any real action. Nonetheless, thousands of diplomats fly in from all over the world for these gatherings, a phenomenon one observer likened to a giant travel traveling circus. Well, one veteran of these summits is Alden Meyer. He's Director of Strategy and Policy for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Well, I'm going to start with a bit of a snarky question, but I have to ask, is there any way of measuring how much energy is being consumed flying these delegates around the world every few months to talk about climate change?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can measure. Obviously, the most energy is used in the international travel. People do come from all over the world, so obviously someone who's flying from Europe to China is expending a lot more energy than someone that's coming in from Japan or Thailand. So you'd have to add it all up. But it's a lot of energy and a lot of carbon.
And there's something like 170 countries represented in China this week. That's thousands and thousands of people flying in.
Yeah, I believe the total count that I've heard for this meeting in Tianjin, which is a rather small meeting by these standards, is 3,000 people.
I gather there is a move to find some sort of permanent location for these talks so that they were not being moved to a new location, a new country every year.
Well, there's been a suggestion by some that maybe you should do what we do with the World Trade Organization, which has a permanent negotiating venue in Geneva, Switzerland, at the UN headquarters there. Negotiators spend much of their life in Geneva, in meetings, in negotiating sessions, so there's not a lot of back and forth travel. The problem, of course, is that we're not at the stage where you have an up-and-running regime like the WTO where people could negotiate around the clock 24/7 around the whole year. So it'd be a lot of wasted time and energy. The basic problem is we don't have the political will in many of the key countries, not only the U.S., but some of the other major countries as well, to cut the kind of ambitious binding deal that the science tells us we need to get ahead of this problem.
Well, can you tell us, I know these are big, complex issues, but in a nutshell, what are the major obstacles to producing some sort of binding agreement?
Well, I think the major obstacles, there's a couple. First of all, there's a perception among many policymakers that doing something of this problem is expensive and requires sacrificing economic growth. The reality is that's not true, but the dominant paradigm is that if you're going to cut back on energy use, that's going to restrain your economy. And that's true whether you're in China, the U.S., or other countries. So that's one obstacle. The other is fairness and equity. There's a sense among the developing countries, the major developing countries like China, India, Brazil, South Africa, that countries like the U.S., Japan, and Europe haven't done enough to cut our own emissions, given that we built our economies on the Industrial Revolution and are responsible for the bulk of the greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
From the industrialized countries, they say, well, that may be true, but unless you do more, you being the major developing countries, we can't solve this problem. They're both right, but the problem is they talk past each other and they can't get into a constructive dialogue about a win-win strategy to get beyond that roadblock.
Is there any sense of urgency to actually producing binding agreements at these UN talks?
Well, there was some urgency building up to Copenhagen because it was a pretty high-level summit. You had a number of heads of state, including President Obama. The good news is it did get a number of the countries, including the U.S. and China, to put their pledges on the table of what they were willing to do. The bad news, of course, is that you can't have heads of state doing the technical negotiations. And as we saw in Copenhagen, the whole process basically came crashing down around them the last few days there. Now, I think what they're looking for in Cancun is to do something a little more incremental, not to get the whole deal done, but to get some trust-building blocks in place. That would actually be a step forward and I think help rebuild the credibility of the UN process. If they can't get even that, I think this process is in real trouble.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
That's Alden Meyer. He's Director of Strategy and Policy for the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Banks misbehaving, calls for an investigation. That very contemporary combustible combination came together with stunning results in 1933, thanks to a lawyer named Ferdinand Pecora. Last year, when the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was formed, chaired by Phil Angelides, Speaker of the House Pelosi invoked the precedent of Ferdinand Pecora. And now Michael Perino, a law professor and former Wall Street litigator, has written a book about the Pecora investigation called The Hellhound of Wall Street. Welcome to the program,
Michael. Thanks Friedman. For having me.
And Ferdinand Pecora was counsel to a Senate probe of the great Wall Street crash of 29 and the banking misdeeds that surrounded it. Tell us about who he was and where he came from.
He was a former prosecutor from New York. He had been a district attorney in Manhattan for a dozen years. And he was born in Sicily, came to this country in the 1880s when he was just 4 years old, and grew up underneath the L in Chelsea.
So here was an Italian immigrant whose only chance at a legal education had been law school downtown, who is named counsel to a Senate investigation that had been going nowhere until he was brought up, and he goes up against some of the most powerful people on Wall Street. That's a great contrast right there.
It was an amazing contrast, and it was a contrast that was overt to the people at the time. I mean, there was no shortage in irony of this Italian immigrant. And you have to remember, at the time, there were these stereotypes of Italians that a lot of people believed in, that Italians were anarchic criminals, that they were unintelligent. And here was this stunningly good lawyer uncovering the misdeeds of the Anglo-Saxons who ruled Wall Street.
Speaking of whom, one was Charles Mitchell, Sunshine Charlie Mitchell. Tell us about it.
Sunshine Charlie Mitchell was the chairman of the board of the National City Bank, which a few name changes later we know as Citibank. He was perhaps the preeminent banker of his day. He had really single-handedly transformed the way Wall Street operated, making a fortune for himself in the process, by focusing on selling securities to middle-class investors, many of whom had never bought a security in their life before. And he turned Citibank's securities selling arm, the National City Company, into the largest investment bank in the country.
Part of what scandalized the nation during the Pecora hearings was how the bank compensated its officers and how it treated its clerks and other junior employees. The officers got plenty rich.
They did get plenty rich. And you have to remember, going into these hearings, there was a lot of sort of amorphous anger at Wall Street. But most of it was directed at sort of what you might think of as the bottom dwellers on Wall Street, the shady pool operators and the short sellers. What Pecora succeeded in doing was really showing how these men who were supposed to be of unimpeachable integrity, the leaders of the most elite financial institutions on the street, engaged in many of the very same practices and became rich as a result of it. You have to remember, you know, these hearings are occurring at the worst depths of the Great Depression. So we have people standing in bread lines, we have 25% unemployment, and Pecora is revealing for the first time that Mitchell paid himself millions of dollars.
You write in the book that the officers of Citibank, this was how Pecora saw it, were paid potentially enormous amounts only if they were able to sell vast amounts of securities. And since they did not bear the cost of securities that went down in value, they had incentives to sell as many securities as possible. This sounds awfully familiar.
It does sound awfully familiar. And if you read those hearing transcripts from 75 years ago, there's an eerie ring to all of them. Mitchell had built up a huge network for selling to middle-class securities. But with a huge network came a huge overhead. And he was constantly cajoling and berating his salesmen to make more securities. He actually said that the bank manufactured securities. And with Mitchell constantly at their backs and the prospects for good securities sort of waning as time went by, they went and sold more and more shoddy securities, the bonds of sketchy South American countries and various other enterprises that were almost bound to fail.
Very reminiscent of what happened in the mortgage market in recent years.
Extremely reminiscent. I mean, we have fancier terms for it now. We call them collateralized debt obligations and other things, but basically it boils down to the same thing.
This was the jungle. This was the unregulated jungle of Wall Street.
Pure laissez-faire. At this point in the late 1920s and up to the hearings, Washington had never regulated the securities markets. There was some federal regulation of banking, but at this point, Wall Street was pure laissez-faire.
How much credit does Pecora deserve for the reforms that President Roosevelt, who at this moment is just entering office, presidents were inaugurated in those days in March, and the critical hearings were unfolding just before that, the reforms that FDR ultimately championed?
I think he deserves a huge amount of credit, and here's the reason why. One of the most famous laws to pass during that first 100 days of Roosevelt's administration was the so-called Glass-Steagall Act. And Glass-Steagall, as many people know, did primarily two things. First of all, it separated commercial and investment banking. And second, what it did was to create federal deposit insurance. Glass-Steagall had actually been kicking around Congress for a couple of years. And in the month before PCORA became counsel to the hearings, it actually went down to a fiery defeat at the hands of Huey Long from Louisiana in a very famous filibuster. But when PCORA came along, and PCORA, I have to say, was the beneficiary of incredible timing. He put Charlie Mitchell on the stand at precisely the time the banking crisis of 1933 hit. With every bank across the country shuttered and PCORA revealing all of the wrongdoing that was happening on Wall Street, Glass-Steagall sailed through relatively easily and actually was much more extensive than it otherwise would have been. Deposit insurance wasn't even dreamed about in January of 1932. In the spring of 1933, it passed easily.
Yeah, you write that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was very skeptical about federal deposit insurance. Some states had tried it. He said it didn't work. But the public mood was changing, and banks were also closing all over the place. And so what had been a very radical measure earlier becomes law.
That's right. And his vice president, Garner, basically told Roosevelt, you know, if you want people to put money back in the banks, you're going to have to give them federal deposit insurance. And as we look back on it now, we can see that that federal deposit insurance proved to be one of the most important structural reforms to the banking committee to emerge from the New Deal.
Michael Perino, thank you very much for talking.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Perino's book about Ferdinand PCORA's investigation of the Great Crash is called The Hellhound of Wall Street.
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
A chip bag that's made from plants, so it's compostable. If sun chips change for a brighter tomorrow.
But now Frito-Lay, the company behind sun chips and that ad, is pulling most of its 100% compostable bags from grocery shelves. And here's why. We've gotten a lot of complaints that it's too loud. We've reached out to Brad Rogers. He is Frito-Lay's North America Research and Development Manager for Sustainable Packaging. Brad Rogers, I have heard people liken the noise of this bag to breaking glass. There was the blogger who described it as not just loud, but a quality of loud that was impossible to ignore, like 100 little old ladies in the theater all uncrinkling their hard candies at once. Fair description?
Well, I don't know about that, but it definitely is a different sound than the conventional packaging that we would typically utilize, kind of a louder, higher-pitched noise that it does give off.
Why? Why are these bags so loud?
Well, trying to make that package so that it would be compostable, the materials that we had to choose from today are such that this is the property that you get from it.
Well, let me bring in Chris Kuchenmeister as well. He's a spokesman for Frito-Lay, and he's also on the line with us. Let me ask you, once this bag was introduced, did SunChip sales actually suffer?
Well, what we've seen with the SunChips brand and its sales, it's hard to pinpoint to just about anything. I'd say the brand is in a solid position. We're seeing some positive momentum right now, but obviously there are a lot of factors that play a role in how sales perform. The noise of the bag, yeah, it absolutely could have played a role in any sort of effect on the sales. And quite frankly, we're very interested in hearing what consumers are saying about the bag. What we're trying to do is use that feedback as we develop the next generation bag.
Brad Rogers, is it back to the drawing board now, trying to come up with another compostable bag that doesn't sound quite so loud?
Not so much back to the drawing board, but as Chris mentioned, there's always room for improvement in any package, and we're constantly doing that, even with our existing packages today.
And I should mention, SunChips is now available in 6 flavors. Y'all are keeping the original flavor in this compostable bag, so if people want to go buy it, it's out there.
Yes. Keeping it in that one flavor, too, also gives us the opportunity to introduce next-generation packages as they become available. We'll have a place for it to automatically go and be able to measure that consumer response very quickly.
Okay. We've been talking to Chris Kuchenmeister, spokesman for Frito-Lay, and also to Brad Rogers, the company's North America Research and Development Manager for Sustainable Packaging.
Potato chips, how my mouth just drips. Potato chips, how my mouth just drips. Crunch, crunch, I don't want no lunch. All I want is potato chips. Potato chips, how my mouth just...
This is NPR News.
And while you're clicking there or doing whatever else you're doing this morning, give a listen to Michael Norton. He's an associate professor at Harvard Business School, and he's been looking at the way that Americans perceive wealth in a forthcoming paper.
Wealth inequality is an interesting thing to ask about because it encompasses a lot of other issues. So, for example, if we ask about income, people have a sense of how much income they make, and they have a sense of the minimum wage, and they can kind of think pretty clearly about, you know, income distributions and things like that. Wealth is something that is much more complicated because it involves all kinds of calculations. So it involves the value of your mortgage. It involves the things you have in savings. It involves your debts. It involves your accumulated wealth over generations. And it turns out that wealth inequality is very static across generations.
Let's define that term that you give there, wealth inequality. You're basically talking about what slice of all the national wealth belongs to the richest 1% or the lowest 10%, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And if you look at most statistics, the bottom 40% of people in the United States basically have zero wealth.
They're not all unemployed, but you're basically saying they either don't own a house or the house that they own is worth less than what they owe on it. If you looked at their net worth, it's nothing.
That's exactly right. And many of them, of course, have negative net wealth. But the latest estimates for the top 20% of Americans is that they have something like 85% of the wealth in the United States.
So you were beginning with those facts, but then you went on to survey people because you were asking not what is your situation now, but what kind of country do you want? And what did you find?
The first thing we wanted to do was ask people, do they know what the distribution of wealth is right now? And then, as you just mentioned, we also wanted to ask people, what sort of society would you like to live in if you got to choose from scratch? And what we find is really two things. One is that people really underestimate what the actual level of wealth inequality is in the United States right now. And then in addition to that, when we ask them how unequal would you like it to be, they want things to be even more equal than they think they are, which is already more equal than they actually are.
What do people want? If people could just dictate the kind of country they had, what would it be?
If you think again in percentage terms, so the top 20%, as I said, have 85% of the wealth. Most Americans want them to have roughly 35% of the wealth. You're talking about 50% of all the wealth in the United States, which, as you can imagine, is a very, very large number. People would like that to be more evenly distributed across people with less income.
That's a colossal change.
That's exactly right. And I think one of the reasons that we see people having a disconnect between understanding how much wealth inequality there really is this very strong American belief in the ability to be socially mobile and to be mobile with your wealth. So people have very strong beliefs that across generations and even in their own life, they can go from rags to riches. And it's certainly possible. I mean, one of the fantastic things about America is that that is in fact possible, but it's much, much rarer than people believe, and especially wealth transmission. So money that goes from generation to generation to generation is very flat, so it tends to perpetuate a great deal over time.
Is there any country that looks like the more equal country than Americans told you they wanted?
The closer countries to what our respondents wanted are countries that are amusingly dissimilar to us, such as countries like Sweden. But for example, even Sweden has a much more unequal distribution of wealth than our respondents told us they would like the United States to have. And I should say the other thing that we found is not just that people think things should be fairer in some sense than they are, but that there's wide agreement about that. So if we look at very rich people and very poor people, or if we look at Republicans and Democrats, all of these groups think that wealth should be more equally distributed when we ask them these questions than it actually is.
Well, Michael Norton, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
He's an associate professor at Harvard Business School.
A New Jersey lawmaker has introduced legislation to make the penalties harsher for cyberbullying. This comes after the suicide of Rutgers University freshman Tyler Clementi. He jumped off a bridge a few days after two fellow students recorded Clementi's romantic encounter with another man. As Nancy Solomon reports, the episode is raising questions about whether schools are doing enough to teach kids the basics of digital citizenship.
The two students who were arrested on invasion of privacy charges haven't said why they tried to broadcast a video of Clementi's sexual encounter with another young man. But the tragedy is widely seen as a case of cyberbullying and homophobia. Yet the two alleged perpetrators, Clementi's roommate Darun Ravi and Ravi's friend Molly Way, were by all accounts good students who had no history of cruel behavior.
I think it's the case that good kids can do terrible things.
John Pelfrey is with the Berkman Center for Internet and Society and the author of Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives. He says more laws on cyberbullying aren't going to change bad behavior. Instead, adults need to reach out to kids in the new hybrid world young people live in that is both virtual and real.
We need education, we need mentoring, we need parenting, we need to have good law enforcement, we need to have social workers figuring out how to reach out in cyberspace as well as in real space and so forth. It's an all-hands-on-deck kind of an issue.
Schools have been late to the party overall. I mean, I think that the technological revolution has in some cases outpaced schools' ability to keep track of it.
Jim Steyer is founder and CEO of Common Sense Media, a nonprofit that provides information about movies, video games, and technology for children. It has written a curriculum to help schools teach digital citizenship. It focuses on how to teach kids to think critically about the internet and make ethical decisions about its use. Steyer says he was flooded with requests as soon as it was released.
There is so much education that needs to be done, and for the most part, kids who are in college today never received any form of digital media education or literacy or citizenship training when they were in high school or middle school.
The school where Ravi and Way both graduated from last June, West Windsor Plainsboro High School in New Jersey, has on its website a long list of 21st century competencies required for graduation. The list includes financial literacy and environmental literacy, but makes no mention of the digital world. Officials there won't comment on whether or not they teach students about cyberbullying, but the state does require it. When students arrive at Rutgers University, they can attend optional freshman orientation sessions that teach etiquette on the internet, as well as the dorm room. Caitlin Sheeran, a junior at Rutgers, says she remembers signing a contract as a freshman that specified the need for respect among students.
I think the two kids who did this are obviously not good people. I mean, I would never think of invading my roommate's privacy like that. It just wouldn't come to mind. To me, it's something that's sick.
Like many students here, Rutgers senior Henna Kalik is dismayed by Tyler Clementi's suicide. But, she says, the problem is that the rules of the internet are not clear.
There's no, like, guideline that's set down for us when we start using the internet at an early age or at any age, so I think it's a free-for-all.
But it doesn't have to be. Researchers say social workers, teachers, even parents need to reach out to troubled kids online. They're not talking about monitoring or limiting access, but providing the kind of brick-and-mortar services available at community centers, schools, and health centers, in the virtual world as well. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.